What kind of beats does a computer like? Algorithms. Hey, guys. No screaming allowed. That's good. You arrived somehow or another over the internet at Nerd Roundup. If you've never been to a Nerd Roundup before, you have my condolences. But you're here anyway, and so we've prevented your computer from switching channels to anything else because, damn it, we're a Nerd Roundup. What do we do at Nerd Roundup? We talk about, I'd make a list of links I've been looking at. They're usually technical in nature, and I bring on friends of mine who are programmers, consultants, pretty smart fellows with all sorts of different views, and we just kick around the news of the week with an eye to what technically is going on. And I don't really see that anywhere else online, so I figured I'd do it myself. Teams that can relax and have fun together can do about damn near anything, and the only way I can show you how to do that is just to sort of do it as a demonstration. So today, we've got Greg Young, we've got John Kern, and James Grinning. Hey, guys.
Oh. How's it going?
I thought it was, what's his name?
Oh, what's his name?
Good old what's his name.
Yeah. I know that face. I can't put the name right now. So, Greg, we'll let you go first. What you been up to, my friend?
Oh, I was doing a workshop out in Europe, actually. It was kind of fun since I couldn't get my passport renewed in time to actually go, so I got to do it remotely.
That's great. You were talking about having to work all morning. What was the workshop on?
Oh, just going through some stuff with event sourcing, and the content of the workshop is not really any problem for me. I've done it once or twice.
Yeah, I've done those things for you. Given the same thing so many times, you can just show up without notes and do the whole thing.
John, yeah, pretty much.
John, what have you been up to this week, John?
Oh, just speaking of presentations, just kind of kicking off with a pretty cool team. Did a bit of a kind of my take on Agile and Lean and how I do software development. Just in the trenches and pragmatic and kind of painting a picture of what the possible is for the group, and then we'll begin to engage and mentor and coach and find out where their gaps are and things that we could do to improve the current process. It's cool. Nice little Q&A session. It had been a little long.
I'm just curious, how much data collection do you do beforehand?
Well, we had a 2-hour session with the team about a month ago, and then we've been observing a handful of ceremonies so that it will kind of sprinkle in some anecdotal observations and just, but this was a little bit of a wider context for, other folks in the company that might not necessarily be participating in the workshop. We don't have, we don't bring the entire world there. So an opportunity to hear what is the Agile and Lean? What does it mean to me, and how do we deliver value?
There was a book back in the day, it was What to Expect When You're Expecting. And so it wasn't about being pregnant. It was about what to kind of expect when you're getting there. It sounds like you're doing a similar thing. Mr. Grinning.
Yeah.
What be you doing this past week?
I've got this group of people in India and some in Germany trying to learn test-driven development. And then in C++. So that's kind of fun. I've got my C++ shirt on in honor of that.
That's awesome.
You did tell them that they write the test first, right?
Yeah, of course. Well, just one test.
It has been fun, James. For some reason, James had some moment of intellectual weakness or whatever and asked me if I could help out. So I've kind of had fun kicking around C++.
Yeah, it's been great to have you help. So there was kind of a big group, and I thought, monitoring the exercises, having Dan come and help me, that'd be great. And it's been good so far. I haven't fired you yet.
I'm still in probationary. And my, don't you look good today as well, James. I really like that shirt's really sharp.
You want to see the whole shirt?
Ah, cool.
The different weapons.
The baseball bat.
Beat Dakota in submission. So,
have you been...
The funnest thing that happened to me this week was I did...
this exercise in TDD and C++. That's this sort of test run. I haven't done any C code in a while. And so James took a look at my code, and he was very kind, and he told me all the things I was doing that the cool kids no longer do. A Hungarian was one of the, James said, you know, the Hungarians have disavowed any knowledge of their notation. And I said, fuck the Hungarians. I'm sorry, I did not mean to use such a language, but I just sort of...
the chief Hungarian has disavowed Hungarian notation.
Yeah, we were working.
Oh, come on! You know you want to discuss SZs.
We're working in text files. You give me an IDE that will tell me the variable. Fine. Without that, I don't have pins.
I didn't complain about your M's at the beginning of all your words too. So, yeah, which makes me want to hum while I'm reading code. index and this and that and array and.
Yeah, you just don't see any G's.
Yeah, I'm kind of a nut about no Hungarian notation. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm a stupid guy, so I just, whatever I get.
Well, no, it had its place when, you know, giant, massive, shitty C code where you needed to decorate stuff to know, you know, how not to shoot your foot off.
Yes.
But in my mind, in the C++ land, that's when I started to shed that sort of thing, because on Texas Air, the class, right? It's just like, I don't like databases that tell me, you know, if I have to read the same damn prefix in front of something, you're mentally stripping it off anyway. So
they're all caps. They got the all caps field names.
Like stop it already. Just tell me its first name. I don't give a shit about, you know, it's already in a container. Don't tell me the redundant container.
So I was finding that I would type in the header file, and I would call it, I'll say student name. And then I would go to the implementation files, type in student name, misspell student, you know, get the caps wrong on name, forget whether it was a character or, I mean, just over and over again, I'm like, okay, I remember these cognitive crutches I can use. And like I said, there was no ID to tell me, so I had to remember.
Wait,
so
it's like, hey. You used header files? What kind of programming is this that you're going to use header files? Come on, we just put it all into one big file.
Back in my day, we used footer files, son.
And I'm pretty sure that the M underscore came when, oh, this is a class, and classes have members. It's so special. We have to put M on the front of it to make sure we remember it's a member.
So but I'm going to please stupidity here,
plus, everything's a member. So you don't need that anymore. Just think of all the M's that have been wasted.
Yeah, no. Oh, yeah, that's a lot of fonts there.
And the keys.
Has anyone written pseudo object oriented code in C?
Oh yeah, sure.
Pseudo object oriented.
Where you can literally write object oriented code in C.
It's very painful. I did it before. I created a course for C++, and then somehow that popped into my head to challenge myself to do some OO in C, like kind of the, you know, C with classes. And just like I challenged myself once to do a Visual Basic 3 application that also wasn't object-oriented, you can do it, but boy, does it suck.
Oh, my God.
So one thing I found with it is it's actually fairly useful if you're dealing with people who have experience programming in C and you're trying to move them to an object-oriented language.
Yeah, so in the chapter such and such here, and oh, this book, Test-Driven Development for Embedded C, it goes through a big deal about how you could do the polymorphism and pluggable components in C. And at the end, it says, you should really be using C++ for this. But
when I introduce C++, I don't tell them the actual history. I just tell them, hey, with C got complicated. We ended up doing things in modules, and that just sort of led into classes. So I actually don't go back and do small talk and other bullshit. I just say, hey, look, C gets complicated, and you end up making classes, and that's where we are.
C gets complicated, so we decided that instead of using a language that comes with like a 270-page book to get you involved with it, we're going to give you a language that has a 1,700-page book to get you involved with it.
Welcome to C. Welcome to C++. Welcome to C++. James was doing this stuff today. What was that? I forget it was. You were typing. Oh, you were using the array standard array library. I'm like, oh wow, they've got a for each now in C++. That's pretty cool. So the one thing that I did not want to do was I forgot to use my initializers in my classes. So I did my constructors and just listed my members. Yeah, and James told me, hey, that's not the way we do things no more, man. So I have been chastised.
Yeah, when's the last time I did C++? Holy moly.
Okay, and sync compiles.
And we helped build a tool so that I could just diagram it and it wrote the damn code and everything proper.
Yeah, and I know I've dealt with people that only lived in those editors and now they can't write real code anymore.
The happiest thing for me was the fact that I picked up C++ after, I bet 20 years. And just by using TD, I got that thing working. The standards weren't up to current standards, but I could have went back and refactored easily enough. But I can pick up something dead cold on it, use the technology, use the techniques, and still like write useful stuff.
It's awesome because you can write, edit the code and the model updated, edit the model and the code updated.
Cool. Okay.
Where's together when we need it?
So our
I had to look it up. So the C++ programming language is currently up to 1,376 pages.
Yeah, and that's not how to code well. That's the spec.
I think you've got an article about keeping programming languages simple this week, don't you, Daniel?
I do. It's a personal passion. Greg threw an article into the pile recently, just before we started. It was, what do you hate about programming? Greg, what do you hate about programming?
Well, there are quite a few good ones that were put up there. And it was more about what do you hate about programming/programming languages?
Yeah.
So there's just so much that you can go with here. Programming languages that hide things from you would be a good one.
Mm. Yeah.
You like all that?
C# on top of enumerables that are going to be iterating.
Mm. Yeah.
So in other words, they're going to be using the yield inside of them. Okay. And then you're writing a link statement on top of it.
Which is just effectively a for loop with just a whole bunch of honking code between you and the for loop.
Well, no, you can also join them. So you can end up with like three lines of code that is essentially operating asynchronously through all of these different things.
Yes.
And it's completely incomprehensible how it works
and
by reading.
And the thing, not only is it incomprehensible, the code reads like it does one thing, and it may do that thing, it may do something else. I mean, all the little pieces in that stack are being customized, including the enumeration. So God knows, you really just have to trust that the word does what you think it does.
Well, that's pretty advanced, right? Because now you're actually putting something in place to foil the hackers, so you're obfuscating and they'll never figure out what the hell your code's doing. So that's pretty clever.
Yes. Yeah, we keep helping ourselves like this. We're going to be so helped, we won't be able to code anymore. Yeah, I love enumerators. I love the yield statement. Link looks pretty cool where you can write an SQL type thing. I mean, these are nice things to have. But, you know, you take a guy who's like maybe a C programmer, you throw him in C#, then you throw some link at him and say, hey, it's just kind of like SQL. Well, yeah, no, because it's SQL that somebody else is running an enumerator somewhere on. Not exactly the same thing.
Oh, and don't forget, we're gonna have everything running in the thread pool.
Yeah. You might, but unless you somebody's doing tasking, in which case they could maybe have some tasks, some virtual tasks, some one same thread pool. You just don't know. But it looks cool.
We can hide this all inside the link statement. It's just wonderful.
And then you shit the donuts. You can watch somebody do a demo where they go, hey, it's all in one line of code. And the people go, oh, this is magical, choir singing, everything's like, yeah, no, that's not. It's not that simple. I guess the thing I hate the most about programming is just that fact that I have seen so many TED Talk demo praise. Oh, we love this blah, blah, blah thing. And it was always a sales pitch. And I was not smart enough to figure that out it took me a long time. I was the punk. So, do you guys know what a holotype is? Yeah. I didn't either. Sounds pretty cool, though. A homotype is a type of animal. And so this guy wrote a blog, are application holotypes. And so he treats these applications as if they were animals. And he says, here's the main types of animals you can run into on web apps. He lists a dozen or so types of applications. And his theory is that there are only a dozen or so types of things you want to do on the web. And each of those types of things has common characteristics. Yeah, I don't think it's gospel, but I thought it was kind of nice to have in my back pocket. If nothing else, next time somebody asks me about a web app, bet you I'm going to say holotype in the answer, because that sounds pretty cool. I'll just say, hey, you know what your holotype is. Well, you can tell me that, we can go forward here.
Well, I wouldn't be a web app type.
You think you're going to call this web app type? Have you been around this business very long at all, James? You're lucky it's not Latin.
Holotype probably is half Latin.
There's this movement, and some friends of mine are doing this, and I won't name them, but they want to compare complex computer systems to complex life forms. And so there's this whole other sort of thread of consultants who are talking about large applications as if they were organisms.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot to be said for the mastery of evolutionary design and beg, borrowing, and stealing some concepts. I remember I've done that in prior strange application development ideation.
By the way, James, I just looked it up. Hollow is actually from Greek origin.
Oh, it's not Latin. Oh.
Well, are you sure the Greeks didn't borrow it from the Latins before the Latins existed?
Huh? I'm reasonably certain.
Well, the thing is that we a lot of times reason by analogy. So this is kind of like that. So let's sort of figure out what it might be. It's always flawed when you do that, but sometimes it's the only thing you got. So I grok it. I get the fact you can reason about apps as if they were creatures. I'm not sure how far it's useful, but it sounds kind of cool, especially if you get like little shirts with animals on them. That would be awesome.
So I just have to ask on this one, how many of these legacy apps are going to end up being honey badgers?
Or moles.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
They tunnel around. They're kind of ugly.
Dinosaurs.
They do a lot of damage. Yeah.
So, next article, flags are a code smell. And I not only did not like the title to this, I also did not like the essay as well.
Yeah, flags. I mean, feature flags are awesome, yes. But I see what he's saying here. Sure, it's just like a ternary. I remember, code coverage, that you need to turn that into an if-then-else or something, because code coverage, you know the line was touched, but you don't know if it went, you know. So, yeah.
As I was reading through this, I left a little note for myself on it that it seems this guy has never heard of polymorphism.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. Or analysis, for that matter.
Well, maybe the people using the flags haven't, too, because I see this in C programs a lot, where somebody passes in true or false into something, or there's two options, and it would be probably just better to have two functions instead of one function with a question at the front of it.
Yeah. I think that's in an Uncle Bob book.
Mm. Well, you know, he had to learn it somewhere.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah, the thing is if you've got a Boolean, it's a sign that you may actually have two things. And if you continue down that path, you may just be trying to shove two things into one thing. And that's analysis. We should not have one class that does everything.
And also the one sword you're missing is a cyclomatic complexity. Oh, boom. There you go.
Oh, yes.
How many paths are there through my damn app? That was one of my favorite. If I had to like pick one metric, that's a pretty damn good one.
Yeah.
And I remember one time doing a, had to write some really tight code for a missile, and had to do like bit packing to get a dictionary and a set of data in a small area. And the cyclomatic complexity went to hell because all of a sudden I had a 32, you know, like a giant case statement for, you know, something like that. It was a long time ago, but it was kind of fun.
Cyclomatic complexity was actually one of the things that Mighty Moose measured.
Yeah.
Who?
Mighty Moose. A testing tool I wrote some years ago. Basically, what it would do is it would automatically run your tests based on the code that you were changing. And then it offered you all kinds of, like, interesting charts and things like that about your code.
Yes.
One of the main metrics that it gave you was it was a number that would appear next to your method. And it would either be in a red circle, a yellow circle, or a green circle. So it's the number of tests that actually cover this piece of code. And then basically the red, yellow, green was we did a risk analysis based on it.
Oh, cool. Well, you know, various application holotypes have various cyclomatic complexity paradigms. I got to work with this some more. This is sounding really good, guys.
Oh, yeah, the holotypes definitely.
Yeah, you got to match some cyclomatic complexities up to the holotypes. No, actually, John, I agree with you. I think that's probably one of the few metrics that I really, really like about code because it tells you how complex you're writing your functions.
There was a, let's see, what's the guy's name in the UK? His name will come to me, but he did an analysis of open source code bases and compared the cyclomatic complexity of test-driven development code bases and non-test-driven development code bases. And there was a huge difference between their complexity.
Yep. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, there's lots of proxies. You know, length of course, just raw length of the method is a giveaway. Even funny things, number of indentations. Like, you know, brace. You know,
That would be a measure of complexity because there's all those paths, all the different ways you can get through.
And just comprehension, you know, like how much can you get in your holotypical brain?
Damn it.
I'm curious. I'm pretty sure we've all run into this before, but maybe you guys can correct me if I'm off on this. That there was one piece of code at some point in your career where it was something like a 5 or 10,000 line function.
Oh my God.
That nobody actually understood.
Oh wow.
And it works. Yeah. And if there was ever an issue with it, it would be we will fix anything environmental around this to get it working again as opposed to changing anything in this code.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, I remember Win32, at first you could only program it in C, and so the way Windows worked was it would throw you an event from any other control on the system. And that was using HWin, which was a 16-bit integer, and like a couple flags. They were just flags. And so you've got a loop, you receive a couple flags, and I mean, really the only thing you can do now is just do some huge dispatch statement from hell to try to figure out what to do. That's the only thing you can do.
The hell else are you supposed to do in WinMain?
Yeah, you can't do it any other way to make it clear what's going on, really.
My two examples were the TogetherSoft IDE, which was a modeling tool and code kept in sync, had an editor, like a code editor. And that was fairly dicey. So that the approach there was to dance around it as much as possible because it was really the gnarly thing. So that was that one option that you put up there because it was actually the IntelliJ, their first sort of, first evolution of their amazing, crazy knowledge about languages and how to model languages, but it was kind of buggy and a little bit delicate. And then they moved off, they left our company and went and founded IntelliJ. And built RubyMine and I should say JetBrains, you know, that built the all those tools, all those cool languages, right? Because they're brilliant. But that was the one there. And then earlier than that, when I was doing F-14 flight simulation, Fortran, no less, the running on a supercomputer, some wizards of amazing, I'm an engineer, not a software guy. So as a software guy, it was that. What the hell is going on here? Nobody could read it except some original programmers. So I rewrote the core flight, algorithm, aerodynamic stuff, and converted their weird 60-bit twiddling. So it was like really cryptic. I had to ask actual software people, what the hell does this thing do? And turn that into engineering and put something, you know, so it was a great lesson for me, and I carried to this day, is use the goddamn domain, not some weird ass shit, unless you really had to, you know, but don't obfuscate it with stuff that, you know, only a handful of people on Earth can interpret it. So yeah.
My first gig with the federal government, we got the Rational Tool Suite, and Rational had a UML modeling, Rational Rules tool. And somebody put it best, it was like a bunch of monkeys with typewriters. God knows who the hell built that thing. It was the worst UI I've ever seen. It was horrible. But it was cool. It did some cool stuff. It was just implemented in a really bad way.
Yeah, we happily beat it in the market all the time.
Yeah, no doubt about it.
Yeah, because I made a modeling tool that I wanted to use. And it wasn't Rose. Yeah.
I was tempted. I've done case tools many times. I did NetTiers back in 2000s. I've used Rose for Erwin, bunch of different case tools that have their use as long as you can understand what they're kicking out.
Yeah, I mean, the beauty of Together was you could give me a pile of crap C++. I could reverse engineer it and see what the model looks like. Right. So the trick was, you know, it looked like magic. But essentially, all we did was listen to the file event. You know, like we either read the files in to start it, but anything that happened to the file would trigger what's going on? So if you edited your header file or something like that, we read it. Or if you're in the UI and you're modeling and you click and you add in a property, that changes the file, which then causes so it's like this clever-looking, magical, always in sync. The model is the code and the code is the model. Mm-hmm. And that was the secret to success. Because now you could ideate, you could even turn that into a third normal form, you know, SQL, ERD, right? You could just generate my DDL.
Yeah.
So all kinds of cool things you can do once you have that metadata about your models. Anyway.
I think that I'm a big, as you know, I was big in MDA. I think the problem, what I keep running into, and I ran into this a while back with some C++ people that are not related to James at all, some other guys. What I run into is that, you know, you're teaching like this level concept, say UML or whatever, and then you sit down with somebody and they're like, here. And I'm okay with that because let's go figure it out. Because hell, I don't remember half the shit anyway, so I'm okay with figuring that part out. But I get the impression that some folks will jump from low to high level and not have that ability or understanding to pop down to a low level again to fix something. So it's like, this is really awesome. I love MDA. I love the fact you can generate all this stuff out. But do you know how to write a trigger in Oracle? Do you understand like how guards are going to work in C# code, right? So there's these little gotchas that aren't part of the tool. And if you're okay with digging and figuring out, that's great. But I think a lot of people just think it's the magic box that does the magic thing. If it doesn't work, well, we'll just hack at it.
Yeah, that's a fascinating conversation because that was what Optimal J was. Optimal J from CompuWare was, you know, Together soft on steroids at an MDA level, which was more like Rails, where you can use the Rails generator to essentially put it up the scaffolding for a CRUD app like that.
Yeah.
Because there's the model, you know, so to me, Rails is awesome because I'm a nut about the domain model and let the domain model drive everything and keep your damn model view controller glue code as consistent as possible. I would say this even before Rails existed. Matter of fact, back in 95, developing a very Rails-like C++ app with hundreds of classes, you know, I used to say, it's like you hold up the you know, back then, you know, you print out the classes or something like that, and you put a few of them on top of each other, you know, only there'd be smudgy parts where the name changed, you know, because you had such a consistent pattern of code. And that's what an MDA tool can, in theory, help you with, or Rails generator, right? It uses names and the metadata to generate a highly consistent framework-based, you know, approach of all your code should look the same. You know, I always said, we make money on being creative on things the client sees. I don't need creativity across their model view controller, you know, like 10 different ways of doing it. No, you know, get one way. If you get a better way, change everything.
That's a great point. And I tell you, that plays into YAGMI, because a lot of times when I'm coding, I want to do things that I don't need, but I still want to. And so I'll end up adding shit in that I really have no need for at all, and it just makes my life miserable later on. But I'm
being the other side of this. There's the other side of this as well we have to keep in mind, which is not to be too adherent to this, because there's going to be one or two places in your app that kind of break the pattern. A perfect example of this would be if we were to take a line of business system, which is 95% of what it does is basic CRUD coming in and out of databases. It has some basic reports that are coming off of it. But then there's this one report. This one report is real-time updating. It's doing all of these other crazy things.
Yeah. Yep. You need an escape route. You need to be able to not be like the Daniel's saying. So, and Optimal J, tried pretty hard so that you could have those areas that you owned, and the model system just kind of worked around it. But it's tough.
This plays into the flag discussion, because if you have a flag and you're calling it a function, it's a sign you may have two things that you may be using. Maybe polymorphic dispatch is the thing you want to use here, or maybe you have two different types. And the guy makes to his credit, makes that point in the essay. But the underlying problem is not whether you can solve this different ways. It's whether you were trying to solve it the wrong way for the business you currently have. And that's kind of impossible to ask in a generic fashion. So when we try to genericize making code, you're going to be making some low-level decisions no matter what. Any of you guys use AWS?
I do.
Once or twice.
Yeah, I do too. Disclaimer, I love AWS. I've done quite a bit of work on it. AWS also is, oh my God, it has become brain surgery. And the reason why is because managing servers is tough. Managing services across virtual servers is tough. Securities, I mean, all these things, there's like 40 different
things. You don't even want to see the stuff that Event Store has for AWS. Remember, Event Store runs Event Store Cloud inside of AWS.
Yeah. So I understand why AWS became this gargantuan octopus monster. It makes sense. I don't approve of that, but it makes sense. This guy said, hey, why don't I just invent this little layer that does the things I want, which, God bless you, I would do the same thing. Then he went, hey, I'm going to publish this on GitHub so other people can use this layer. And then at this point, I want to kill him with a bazooka because, no, make the layer that does what you want. But once you start advertising this is the layer, guess what? You're just making the next AWS just at a higher level. Just stop already. Just enough.
So well, come on. You know the really fun part is going to be when they now support that model on Azure as well.
Yeah. and the cross.
It's almost like there's a couple things that have gone down this path.
Yeah, and there's a few cross cloud compilers, and those are really cool. I like them, but at the same time, there's already a few, and each cloud provider has different services, so it's already become a mess without stuff like this in it.
But a lot of the tooling is actually pretty useful.
It's not that it's not useful. Oh my God, this stuff in AWS, it's some really, really cool stuff. The problem is that you have to know the entire tech stack to know whether or not to use the default thing or the really useful piece.
We used to have a script that we would use quite a bit internally, which was back when Terraform was still really, really good. And you could basically just bring up a 3 or 5 node cluster in AWS with like one command line.
Yeah. Have you any of you used CloudFormation? Okay, so CloudFormation basically is a big YAML file that describes your cloud. And it's YAML, so it sucks, but it's a descriptive thing. Here's what I want my servers to do, how they talk, just the whole thing. And you just throw that at AWS and it sets up your whole thing, your network, your security, everything you could possibly need, it sets it up. And not only does it set it up, but it sets it up in an atomic fashion where you can like, okay, I don't want to do this anymore. And it tears it all down and you set it up again. So it makes deploying a cloud like deploying code, which is really, really cool.
What gets really scary when you start getting into tools like Terraform is when you get into an organization and realize that they've used Terraform for their entire cloud setup.
Mm.
So they essentially have one Terraform script that is in control of 970 yeah. servers.
And that's why.
And there will there will come a point when somebody accidentally puts in Terraform down.
And this is why the atomic part of CloudFormation is most cool, because you can do red, blue, green deployments with CloudFormation, and something breaks, you're good. But you do it like your own homegrown script in Terraform. It's working without a net. By the way, the Darkling, this is, I'll put a plug in. Darkling guys are really cool. Darkling, the idea is write once in F sharp, and because they're pure functions, maybe they're Lambda, maybe they just, so you write once for the cloud. I think you could combine that with some sort of cloud architecture, maybe also in F sharp, and you could have one language that does everything. So I love the idea of making one ring to rule them all. It's just, this can become just another layer of bullshit if you're not careful.
Just I'm just imagining one ring to rule them all in Don Syme's voice.
He's an Aussie, isn't he?
Yep.
So, in a way, I was distracted a little bit in there, but so AWS has an API for doing this. Why does he need something different? He just doesn't like the form
yeah,
of it, huh?
Yeah, it's not only, he's got multiple APIs. The CloudFormation has got this whole system to just atomically set up stuff and remove it. It's got a command line API, which is awesome, works great. It plugs into VS Code. There's three or four, and then you got a web interface. So there's four different ways to easily get to do all the stuff you want. But they're not good enough for this guy. And I understand, because there's a bunch of stuff there. I mean, you know, like Greg was saying, there's all kinds of little pieces that make sense. But and I get the fact you can get confused. And I'm the first guy to write abstraction layer when I get confused. But don't, like I said, don't give it to people. No, bad. Stop. Have you guys ever used Compiler Explorer?
Oh, yeah, I've played with that a little bit.
That's an awesome tool. It's really a lot of fun. So if you haven't, Compiler Explorer lets you go to a website, type in C, C++, I think there's a bunch of other, a JavaScript, and it will show you on the right how it's compiled. So you can actually compare your source code to the compiler output and learn stuff about what you're actually doing at the after you compile your code, which is very informative.
So how many different compilers are up there?
I looked at it. It's like over 30, I think, now. Hang on, so let me click on the link. Mm-hmm. Oh, this is the, I think this is archive.org. This is the first one. Yeah, it's just a couple here. Just C++. I'll find the recent one. Hang on.
I've just brought it up. There's all kinds of...
I did the other day. It was a ton of stuff.
I'm just making sure they have Visual Studio version 6. I don't see it.
At some point in your career, and we'll encourage everybody to understand what's happening under the hood or whatever your favorite language or platform is. If you're ASP.NET, learn the pipeline, learn how the, you know, if you're .core, learn the MSIL stuff. It's just, you may never need it, but it helps when you're trying to figure out complex things.
This would have been really handy in 2001. I was working with this company, and they had a rule, don't use virtual functions. And so I said, well, why? And they said, because they're big and they're slow. Go disassemble it. Go take a look. And sure enough, the disassembled code for a virtual function is about that big, and a direct function is about that big. Ooh. So, yes, they're bigger. And then, okay, take one step back. What's the context of usage? Well, the direct function call is in a switch case table. And the indirect function call is an indirect function call, right, using polymorphism. So you got these two different things. Guess what the payback was for the footprint size? Don't use polymorphism, but bury it in a switch statement, or use polymorphism and don't have the conditional logic. What do you think?
Polymorphism for the win.
It wins in two switch elements.
Whoa, wow.
At least the thing I looked at the time. So it's like, okay, there you go. You made a very micro optimization. Good job.
That's a great example of looking directly at the code and saying, hey, it must be so because I just see this. I see this in the compiled code, but not looking at the context and everything else.
Yeah, not looking at what problem is being solved and, you know, could I be smart enough about the use of my tools?
As a nerd, when I was doing that C++ course, and I think I did a bunch of metrics around some different ways to invoke something and time the crap out of it, you know. And it's kind of fun. I mean, it's somewhat stupid because, unless you write real-time code, which I was, but most people could give a crap. But that is kind of cool, though, to dig into it and see.
Well, the cool part is, like, why did I fuck up? Like, I'm reasoning logically. I'm a smart person. I'm writing good code. I'm, you know, why am I wrong? And usually when you start digging into something like that, you learn something.
Yeah.
Maybe useless, but yeah.
Well, in the old days, back when we would build weather radar display systems with 12K of ROM and 12K of RAM, then we had to pay attention to where every byte went.
Yeah.
Sure.
You know, I've been told I use too many M's, and I'm trying to cut back. I'm going to go back.
Well, you know, that would just fill up the Intel.
Back in the day, you only had like 6 M's you could use.
You know, if you used an M back in the day, you'd only have 5 letters left for your variable name.
So Apple II Basic, you had a letter and I think one or two numbers. So it's X1, X2, AB, you know, that's it.
Yep, wow. And so if you do M on all of them.
Yeah.
But don't worry. It was an object-oriented Basic, so don't worry.
Yeah, I wrote some code in Apple II Basic that, oh my God, somewhere it's orbiting the Earth like in a nuclear delivery platform. It's bad. It's an evil thing.
I was talking about that flight simulation software. Another fun thing that I learned was as I was debugging it with print statements, because, you know, I'm pro like that.
Yeah.
Everything was awesome. You know, all the tests passed. I'd see things work. And then I took out the print statements and it wouldn't work.
I got two words to go back a bit in time.
Can you get
HyperCard?
HyperCard.
Oh, well, I was hoping maybe you could guess the problem, because I dutifully, as an engineer, you know, tracked it down. Okay, so here's my example. And I was like, okay, now I'm going to bring this over to the cyber supercomputer folks at the, you know, Naval Air Development Center, the big IT room, where I'm like, yeah, I'm an engineer, and this stuff is, what do you mean the system's down because water cooling is broken? Well, that's on a car. Like, what do you have water cooling? Right? I mean, this was a brand new world for me, that goddamn thing, you know, ran with water cooling on the, anyway. So I bring this wonderful, I figured out you've got a problem here. And I had to leave this kind of, I ended up calling it an if quirk instead of like if debug. All right, if quirk, because I had no idea what the quirk was. All I knew is, and they go, oh yeah, that's a known problem with the compiler. I'm like, what? Yeah, it's screwing up the optimization. And, you know, by stopping the optimization with that if code, that's why it works. And so that was also a lesson where I had blind faith. For some reason, because humans wrote the compiler too.
Yeah.
But I had blind faith that, you know, like, no, it must be me. You know,
so anyway. About 10 or 15 years ago, I was writing some .NET code, and I was using the regex object they have. And they got a regex object, you throw some regex, you throw a string, it gives you matches, a collection of matches. So I threw a string, threw some regex, I got my little matches, started to enum down the matches, and .NET said, nope, sorry, I can't do that. I'm like, wait a minute. It's an array of matches. I just have an enum. I want to walk the matches. .NET said, nope, sorry. Can't. So I dug around. I was 2 or 3 hours. The .NET regex object was made pre.NET. So it did not expose an enumerator. Even though it looked the same, it was not an enumerable object. So you just had to for next until you got to nothing. It's like, what? It's like, what? Why would you put a thing that would look the same as everything else and yet make it different than the other things?
Humans.
I think I mentioned this once in the past, although it might have been on another one that I was doing. We used to have embedded systems that we built, and our compiler, after some period of time of us building it, working with it, I should say, it was compiling out 68030 and 68040 code. It had a fixed size symbol table.
Oh, whoa. Oh, my God. Oh, wow.
So what do you think happens when you've now gotten a reasonably large system?
So you have to write your own segmentation code for your symbol table? Tell me.
I think somebody then realizes that, we never put a limit on how big it could be. We just ran off the end because who would ever build a program that big?
It just splatted over whatever was next to
it. No, you literally ended up with refactor to remove symbols.
Yeah. And like I said, you could probably actually segment and write your own link table segmentation code for the win. Wow.
Well, the problem was the compiler wouldn't actually even tell you something like I overflowed my symbol table. Yeah, it would still generate out the code.
Oh, yeah,
it's just the code may or may not work in varying places.
Yeah, we don't need to bother the programmer with everything. We're the compiler guys. We can figure stuff out.
Yeah. Well, no. The big problem with it is, so when you start getting into embedded systems, often the compiler that you're using was last updated 12 years ago by some company that's been defunct since then. You still have software running on the damn thing. Are you going to rewrite all the software for the device as opposed to dealing with these kinds of issues?
Well, in the 80s, we had some binaries that we didn't have any source code for. Yeah, it's like, where'd the tools chain go for this? Where is the source code? We didn't know.
You end up tearing the tool at some point, even today, I would argue you end up tearing the tool chain apart and just saying, okay, give me the metal. Here we go. Fun times.
I have actually been in a couple places, James, you will appreciate this, where we were not allowed to make source code changes.
You were programmers?
But we were allowed to edit the binary.
Oh, my God.
There you go.
Yeah.
So I could, if I found a bug and this was mission critical and it needed to be fixed, I could open up the hex dump of what is going on to the EEPROM, and I could change the hex dump.
I mean, you could chain that, too, for even more fun.
Mm-hmm.
But I could not recompile it.
Yeah, you could do like multiple new ones. Yeah.
That sounds like a pretty sustainable activity.
Sure. I'm sure that all translated back to the right source code eventually.
Oh my God. The company that Bob Martin and I used to work at, when I first joined, they gave me the listings for this embedded product. And it had something I'd never seen before. It was a jump table. And each EEPROM had a jump table in it. Actually, the jump tables were in RAM. It's like, I just could not figure out why they wanted this, but because in the field they found problems, they taught the field guys how to patch the code with these jump tables and things. So they could go and fix something. Then they would, phone in and say, hey, we've got to do something about this because this system's, if it resets, bad things are going to happen.
Right. I got a workaround, but it's not going to last.
Yeah, it's like when your dad told you to hold the antenna a certain way so you could get like the football game or whatever, and you're standing in the corner going,
Yeah.
You guys ever use a microkernel? I haven't. I want to. The microkernel is where it compiles just what you're using all the way to the metal, and it strips everything else out of the kernel, which is cool. But I've never used one.
I might have done a Raspberry Pi, because those are pretty minimal.
Yeah, I Pi doesn't. Yeah, they tried to strip a bunch of stuff out of Pi already, and you can do a lot of cool stuff because you deploy the blob, as you know, James. You actually create a blob to deploy to it. So the next one's minimalism and programming language design. This guy makes a wonderful case that we should design programming languages that only have a fixed amount of complexity, and the rest of that complexity has to be up to the user, the programmer.
What I loved about this one is C++ is crumbling under its own weight.
Oh my god.
Yeah, and it has been for like two decades.
Yeah, James did that for each thing today. I was like, oh geez. Why?
Well, that's kind of handy. I'm surprised I remembered it. But
dang. Oh, yeah. I mean, it's a wonderful construct, but no, not just, come on, just stop.
Yeah, I like to use about this much of C++.
I think it's parity with, I have a good friend that we used to do a lot of Java, and he mentioned how the newer Java language has a lot of things. I have a feeling they just steal from other languages, each one. Oh, that's a cool idea. You know, they take from Ruby or take from C++, took from Java. Who knows? I don't know where the origins are, but my guess is it's some kind of feature parity war. Other languages say, hey, we got this for each thing over here. Why can't we have it over in C++?
I'll tell you what would be fun. It would be fun to go to C++ project and say, okay, guys, we're just going to write this as if it were Haskell and just write pure functions, constant, everything, and just decide you're not going to use any mutable classes at all. And you could do that very easily with the libraries you have. But it wouldn't look like C++.
Take a look at C++ lambdas sometime.
Yeah.
And because the syntax is so crazy.
God help you with the compiler error.
Yeah. Well, and then figuring out what the scope of the lambda is, what it's allowed to see and what it isn't allowed to see is kind of, it's like, okay.
Where am I? Need to know I can't basis. Tell you. What am I doing? I can't tell you. What am I changing? I can't tell you. It's
like, well, it is all in a encryption form.
Yeah,
you need to know basis. Sorry, you don't have the clearance.
Yeah, Haskell's like that when you do the lazy evaluation. So you do the lambda up front, and it just doesn't call it at all until some point years from now. God knows it calls it at that point, and that's the only point you can look at it.
I got to say, it's all very cool, but like, no, it's like, does not fit between the ears very well.
There's something very honest about
One very, very cool thing, if you get into compilers a bit with lambdas, is the ability to do lambda inlining.
Hmm. Yeah.
So I've seen that you are going to be passing in this lambda, so I'm going, and I understand that I'm going to be calling that lambda, so I'm actually going to consider it to be a static call.
Yes. Yes.
For your call site?
Yeah.
And now I'm going to inline everything through it.
As long as you don't like use anything else besides the thing I'm giving you, I'm a happy guy. But once that lambda starts running into scope errors or scope issues, like James was saying, God, geez, who knows? you're doing closures. You're doing JavaScript closures. And JavaScript programmers run into the same problem because they end up with this lambda function that's being called, and the programmer many times does not know where he's being, why are you calling me? What am I doing? What am I supposed to do? It's a time of confusion.
Funny, he says that he first learned C++ in 98. I only got into it because I wanted to go OO. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I had been using C, and then I think I tried Smalltalk, but on a PC, it was horribly slow. So then Turbo C++ came out, right? Yeah, and like, oh, I can afford that, and it's not horribly slow. And that's the grand reason why I learned C++, because of the tool that I could afford. And
that was Borland. Borland did the Turbo C++, right?
Borland, right, and it would have been like 91, I mean, early 90s. Yeah.
They had a Turbo C++, they had a Turbo Pascal as well, I think.
Yep. I never did Pascal.
I didn't either. And then it eventually came out with a Delphi, which people loved. Yep. I never used it, but people really loved it.
Yeah, ditto. Never used it.
Pascal was not bad to work in.
What's that, Craig?
Pascal was not that bad to work in.
Hmm.
This is all French.
Somebody on the roundup mentioned APL. Has anybody used APL? Because I haven't. I was told that it like uses Greek letters, that the language is impenetrable, but it's a very brief language.
Yeah, I think
I've used it a couple times. It is.
How about Forth? Forth was trying to gain some popularity embedded back in the early 80s. And we toyed around with it a little bit, but boy, it was a strange thing to work in.
Another one's Algol. I've always wanted to use a Prolog and Algol. I haven't used either one of those.
You know, I would say Algol is a bit of a parent to C++ from. Ah, okay. I did buy Stroustrup's original like big tome about the language, and back in the day when I read books. And I think Algol has kind of had some of the features that got into C++.
I saw a discussion on AI and inference engines where, like, your diagnosis is you have an ugly face because the computer reasons this way. And the guy commented, he said, that's a Prolog did a very similar type thing. It sounded kind of cool. So this next article is Vintage Computer Ads. This is, that's like way back. This is the Wayback Machine. These are all ads for computer stuff from years ago.
I would have been coveting some of this stuff.
I remember coveting some of this stuff.
Is that like a rainbow or something like that? What is that thing?
They have S100 parts in here, and I had an S100 computer, and for some reason I threw it out like 2 years before I realized you shouldn't have thrown that out.
$3,400 for a 10 meg RAM disk. That's a hard disk.
Wow. If you look closely, one of the advertisements in here literally has like the first usage of WYSIWYG.
WYSIWYG.
Yeah, I saw that. Yeah,
it's what you see is what you get. It's literally like the first usage of it.
And it's a big giant screen a small screen with giant letters on it.
Oh my god!
And you wouldn't want what you're getting from this one.
Remember they had like, what was it, a Wang? It was like the whole machine was just word processing. It was a Wang.
Yes.
What you see is what you get.
There's a memory board in here, which I might have bought as a kit. And so I soldered it together, plugged it in. Guess what happened?
Nothing.
Nothing, exactly. Then I took it into my friend at work that actually knows something about hardware, and he starts inspecting. He goes, how many beers did you have while you were soldering this?
Oh, it's like,
well, just two. You know, I missed a whole row of pins.
Oh, my God.
And he just got his soldering iron and went, shh. Yes, that was like an off by eight error. It's not too bad when there were several hundred pins there.
Computers are so picky. So here we have something that would never fly today. We have the girl in the short shorts, a sexy, what is this, a modem?
Especially because it's really close to penile. Just saying.
Oh, my God.
What the hell's Penrose?
The go-go boots on. Oh, me.
Yeah.
And then they've got a real sexy nerd in a couple more things where he has 16 bits instead of just 8. He's got two girls fighting on his ears.
You remember back in the day they had the Charles Atlas ads, the back of comic books where like this big muscle guy would kick sand in the face, and so the guy would buy the Charles Atlas course and like become big and strong.
Mm-hmm.
There's some throwbacks to this. Oh, wow. Yeah. Apple II. Yeah, this was the machine, my friends.
Here comes the one. The next one is about, you know, you being nerd too.
Yeah, they wanted me to do that. I wasn't available that week, so I said, okay.
Dan, isn't that you before?
Yeah. 16-bit, wow. SS-16. And we all remember the SS-16, of course.
Sounds like nuclear missile. That submarine.
What the hell is this thing?
Funny. It's a microcomputer. It doesn't mean it does anything other than inputs and outputs.
It does nothing in 16 bits. That's the important thing here.
I remember my first, I think it was a 286, and you know, got a coprocessor and, you know, that whole, and got upgraded to a 386 eventually and a 486 and then the Pentium.
Yeah.
All the kids these days.
Yeah.
Yeah, but were you on a 386 SX or DX?
Yeah, that's right. The DX had the math coprocessor.
Yeah, I usually went for the math coprocessor because, you know, I'm an engineer.
Yeah, you want to do math.
So, Dan, this is like the card I would have built.
Yeah, I was looking at this is almost discrete electronics. It's down to the chip level here. It's amazing. 16K of RAM.
And I remember the VAX 11, maybe PDP. I think it was some of the computers we used in the test cells for the cruise missile engine stuff. Yeah, a board, you know, giant board was like 1K.
Here's 2 cents a byte. I currently have a 1 terabyte, 1 terabyte hard drive. So I think I'm like, I have $2 million or something. It's incredible.
And I do remember buying a 10 megabyte hard drive. It wasn't $3,000.
Yeah, I think I got the 20. I saved up for the 20.
Yeah.
64K for only $1,500.
Now scroll a little bit further on this one. Stop right there. Go back to that one. You see those switches on the front?
Oh, yeah. Those are dip. Are they called dip switches?
No, those are not dip switches. Those are toggle switches for keying in the binary you need to boot the system.
There you go.
These are the good old days. Now, this is, a decade before what you're talking about, John.
How the hell does that even work? I don't even know how that thing.
I tried to do it once, but my off by one error prolific, my ability to make off by one errors was too great. Yeah, so the other guy who was more meticulous, he was able to boot the thing up, but I could never get the damn thing to work.
We got
to
get Netflix going. James, get the thing booted.
The original...
I wonder is if we were to take a 19-year-old computer science student today and show them that, what they would think.
Wow. Great thought.
There's actually a good lesson in that we have successfully abstracted this layer. I mean, the stuff we've pulled around with, we don't care about that anymore, right? We're able to work most of the time, except for James and your embedded folks. Oh, wow. This guy's like wearing a tuxedo to do God knows what. Look at the floppy draw. Wow, that's amazing.
Yeah.
That's one of them 5 1/4-inch deals.
Yep. No, that's the 8-inch. Isn't that the 8-inch?
It may be. That was the huge rascal.
And those things made such a great noise when you were using them.
And then when you crashed it, you would hear tuck, 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 tuck.
Yeah. It'd be ticking along through the tracks.
Three-button mouse.
Wow. All the kids out there, the one kid that watches the show, you would never even know, right?
Oh, my God. Yeah, so this is fun stuff. I think the interesting thing Greg was bringing up earlier is the way they were selling these things is changed from then to today. It's not just the tech is like way back stuff. It's like the things we thought was cool isn't cool anymore. Nobody would really care whether or not you had a floppy, whatever this thing is. Oh, my God.
That guy's got does he have a floppy disk?
I don't know. He's got an Apple. This Apple computer. Oh, geez. That two Apple. Oh, that's cool. Look at the joysticks. Cool stuff. Okay, so last one here. Somebody stole Seth Green Bored Ape, and he wants it back. So Seth Green, who I guess is some sort of famous person, bought an NFT, which is this non-fungible transaction, as a piece of digital art that is a bored ape. I'm not really sure what that is. So he bought it for thousands and thousands of bucks. Somebody stole his ape, and he's very sad. And so it's been resold. So the crazy thing is they stole his NFT, bad. He's on Twitter. He found the guy who has his ape, his little monkey picture. He found the guy. The guy won't give it back to him. The guy sold it for, I think, $100,000. And so he's like, please give me my monkey picture back because I want to do a TV show with it.
Is that what started monkeypox?
That's all kinds of, I don't know. I wonder if he would, for maybe just $200,000, I will draw this man a picture of a monkey. I can do this. I'm the guy. Yeah, it's just, wow.
My son's involved in one of these NFT things. He's got some friends that are artists, and he's being the nerd part of their business, writing the code for the, I don't know what blockchain and whatever is needed for this.
But the thing
is, when your computer nerd son starts talking to you and you don't understand what he's saying.
I get that from my oldest son, yeah. So the crazy thing I just thought was not only the NFT and you got the monkey, but then he actually is able to talk to the person who got it. And this guy didn't steal it, by the way. He got on Twitter and said, hey, can I get this monkey thing? And Seth Green's like, that's my monkey picture. And so you're able to communicate with the guy who has your stolen monkey picture, and the guy actually makes like an amount to buy my house selling your monkey picture. It's like, wow. The world makes no sense anymore.
Yeah, so he's not just going to give it back because
bought it. Yeah, hey, that's a picture of a monkey. I'm not going to give that to anybody. Hey, I got some standards.
But you can buy
it.
Yeah. You can buy it back for, I don't know, $1.50?
How much do you miss your monkey?
Yeah, that's right. That's this board ape. That's not just any monkey. It's an important thing. So, guys, what have you been, Consumable Relief? What have you been reading or watching? Anything interesting? Greg?
Oh, mostly just trying to keep up with varying time zones and classes. And it's much, much harder to teach classes and do consulting remotely than it is to fly to them.
Yeah. I agree with
True that.
For sure.
It is a bit of a challenge, yeah.
John?
Yeah, I mean, I try to go to my favorite little five and dime lunch counter at least once a week. So there I at least get, unless I'm meeting somebody to chat, I'll get a chance to read a book. And it's still working my way through the book called Catalyst and How to Change Anyone's Mind. And through a school budget season. So
you're going to have to read that Catalyst.
Yeah, my wife said, yeah, don't try that at home. Yeah, don't worry.
Yeah, that's no problem.
It's interesting, though. Yeah.
James, any good books or TV?
No, let's see. Good books. I picked one up from a friend of mine. He said he really liked it, The Three-Body Problem. It's a sci-fi.
Oh, yes.
Have any of you guys read it? Yeah, you give it a
excellent.
Thumbs up?
It's most excellent, yes.
And I just started listening to a Harry Bosch novel. I liked those, and I was working in the garage, putting a new garage door opener, listening to my audiobook while I'm doing it. I thought a garage door opener going a lot quicker than that, but it took me all day, but I moved slow.
You know, there's a new Bosch series out on video.
Yeah, and it's his afterlife, right after he leaves as being a cop. Now he's on the other side.
Yep.
We have a Bosch dishwasher, but it's not Harry.
Yeah, that's too bad. I mean, those are good.
Yeah. Right?
It's a different kind of holotype. It doesn't have hair.
There you go. So you guys are crossing holotypes. It's very bad. So I started a new audiobook, Red Rising, which I actually read the regular book, and I'm going to listen to the series. Most cool. If you like the Harry Potter emergent type series, this guy actually gets a real modern adult version of that. Best one I've read, Red Rising. I also started watching True Blood, which I sort of took to be redneck vampires. I fired those guys, and then Melissa and I started watching another show. I can't remember what it's called, but it's basically gypsy werewolves. So I'm thinking maybe at some point the redneck vampires could fight the gypsy werewolves. I probably would watch the entire series of that, but I don't know. Not making any commitments. I watch a lot of streaming because we have it, and I just leave the TV on. I feel like we're kind of running out of ideas with streaming. It's just not fun.
Well, yeah, I think
I'm just curious with the gypsy werewolves. Are these like American gypsies, or are we talking like pikies?
Oh, they're American gypsies. It's a sad situation. The life of the American gypsy werewolf. I learned this. They're picked on discriminatingly.
Well, obviously they're if they make it into a television show, they're going to need to do a wedding at some point in it.
With singing and dancing and the moon?
No. Was it there was the show on like Discovery Channel or something like that. It was like My Big Fat Gypsy Wedding.
It's a Greek wedding.
Greek.
Was it Greek? I thought it was gypsy.
My Big Fat Gypsy Werewolf.
Yeah, that's because the werewolf eats way too many different holotypes.
Yeah, it's that's not going to get
the,
all
the details. What was the show with the gypsies on it that was on, like, the Discovery Channel or whatever? It was, like, a completely whacked-out show where all kinds of crazy things would happen.
Shark Week?
Was it no. It was all about gypsies.
Okay. I was going to say, you know, Chocolat, but it's just a movie with Johnny Depp, and yes, I think they're gypsies, and then they fall in love with somebody, yeah. But I don't know. I don't watch enough TV to know about gypsies.
So there's a great sci-fi series on Amazon Prime, J.K. Simmons and Chrissy Spacek. And I damn if I can remember the name.
I was correct. My Big Fat American Gypsy Wedding is the name of it.
There you go.
Oh, wow. Dang. I sit corrected.
Yeah, I'm surprised there's no trademark infringement because that's pretty damn close to the original. Maybe they got permission.
Yeah, I'm waiting on sort of underground mole people. That, you know, I think maybe there's a few things we haven't gotten yet, but we're running out of stuff.
That sounds like a 1950s sci-fi.
Underground. Doesn't mole. Yeah.
That would be cool.
Gypsy werewolf mole people, huh?
Yeah.
They solve crimes. But because every series, they have to solve crimes at some point, and I don't know why, but it seems important. I think the reason they say solve crimes is that it gives them an opportunity to bring in new people every episode or season, and so that there's a mystery to figure out, whereas if they didn't have a mystery, then it's like, why are we watching this?
I misspoke slightly. There's not six episodes. There's six seasons of that.
Wow.
That's a lot.
That sounds like about five seasons too many.
That does sound like a lot.
Oh, I did.
It was actually popular for a while.
I did listen to an interesting group, like three or four folks talking about To Kill a Mockingbird.
Ooh. Oh, yeah.
You know, just the book. So it was like professors and people who teach, you know, Southern literary stuff, and it was kind of fascinating. I only asked one question in chat about how true was the movie to the book. Did they miss any, did they leave anything out? And so they had great answers, because they said, well, you know, one guy said, it's sort of like, in the movie, 60% was the trial and Atticus. Mm. You know, so it was like 60-30 trial. In the book, it was 36. It was the opposite. But there were other strange things in the book that worked in the book, but they said probably wouldn't have worked. Like, it makes me want to go read it, because near the end, they're even talking about the kids and they're talking to the children in school about, like, Hitler and the Holocaust. And, you know, so it would just been like some weird red... you know, other thing that got thrown into the movie. So they had a couple of examples of stuff that was in the book, fascinating to read, but would have been probably weird. And the one guy said he was actually at the courthouse, and back in the day when they made the movie, they came in, they measured everything. It's too much natural light, so they made the studio in Hollywood so they could control the lighting instead of, you know, have this giant windows letting in random light. You know, so they have a to the inch type replica. But he said it's pretty cool to go there and actually be in the courtroom.
Oh, wow.
You know, where it was, you know, set.
I read a book about how to plot novels, and they used To Kill a Mockingbird as an example of how to plot a good novel.
One of my favorite quotes of all time is actually in To Kill a Mockingbird.
Oh, do tell.
Yeah.
The one thing that does not abide by majority rule is a person's conscience.
Ooh, I like that. That's good.
Ooh, is that in as a Geordi man type? Some kind of a reference to an Englishman that I think, like a Geordi man.
Oh, wow.
No. As in majority rule.
Oh, majority. Sorry. Okay.
You guys listen to podcasts?
News.
Okay, so they're right across the
corridor. I'm pretty sure everyone here is listening to a podcast now.
Yeah, so there's a BookSmart Studios has a podcast called Banished. And I thought it was going to be yet another one of those kind of conservatives. Oh, they canceled my school or whatever. But what it actually is, she's a scholar. She goes online and finds the latest controversy over speech. In this case, it was about the musical Grease from the 1980s. People thought it was racist, sexist, or whatever. And then she goes and finds other scholars who are expert on this whatever, and then she explains all the history and things about the stuff that you're never going to hear by listening to people yell at one another on Twitter. I thought it was a really cool concept. Looking forward to hearing some more of it.
I'll share the link to this one. You might find it fascinating.
Please do. I'd like to. Very, very interested. Okay, so let me do my goodbye thing. Well, it's been an hour and 16 minutes, and you have lost it, and you can't ever get it back, no matter how hard you try. I'm Daniel Markham, DanielMarkham.com. This is Nerd Roundup. I will see you on the internet.